Okay. So, you're going to complete the participation thingy, and make sure that you write your name. I forgot to say your name on top, so if you just give it to me without your name, I won't know who participated. So that's just some of the data I will use for deciding what your participation credit is going to be. Okay, and then just make sure that you give it by the end of the class. There is the visa commercial. I wouldn't even want to know what you want to say for that, but I would like to say it's priceless. I have another question. Does anybody know what Stockholm syndrome is? And you figured this out. So what has this got to do with the class? I'm again afraid of asking this question, and yet I have my own answer, but I noticed the fact that a lot of people posted very nice things about Lisp in the five things that they enjoyed in the class. And so what is Stockholm syndrome, for those of you who know what it is?
Where a person is kidnapped.
Exactly. So the victims start liking their captors. And, there are other ways of interpreting Stockholm syndrome for this class that I would like not to do. The one that I would like to interpret is that some of you seem to have liked Lisp after the entire semester was over. So I don't know whether it is Stockholm syndrome or not, but we'll leave that at that. A couple of announcements. The final homework is due today, and the solutions will be posted tomorrow. The participation sheet should be filled and returned today, and I also noticed that people are showing natural intelligence. Suddenly some people are actually posting additional blog comments. I don't necessarily mean Trevor, but good. Anytime if you have nice things to say, thoughtful things to say about some question that's been asked, but you have to give the numbers as of today. Okay. I'm told that the CES evaluations are online. I encourage you to do them. I won't see them until you are gone and your grades are given, but it'll be useful to know actually what happened in the class, especially the comments. Okay. Regarding the final exam, there are choices. You can do it in class, which would be on the next Tuesday from 9:50 to 11:40 a.m. And you can take it home and do it. There could be a take-home version, which essentially means I would wind up giving it sometime before this weekend, and it will be due by Tuesday, because I cannot do it much later than Tuesday because I have my own deadlines as to when I give the grades to them. And I guess we all would like this, but that's not allowed. I'm going to just in a second take a show of hands as to which one you would rather go with, and then we'll do that. Okay. I do want to tell you what you are voting for. So this is the in-class, this is the take-home. In-class is like Band-Aid, just removing it very fast. Done fast, you don't need to worry about it. After 1.5 hours, you go home free. Of course, I also like it. It's graded, gets graded fast. It's so much easier to grade blank sheets. The take home, the problem, of course, is it doesn't get done fast, and people tend to wait until the take home is given and then start reading for the entire semester, and then they complain that, my God, this exam is so long. The way when you come to the in-class exam, whatever you study or not study, it's on your time. And the only thing that you count is this 1 hour, 40 minutes, right? But if I give you the take home, then until you open the take home, you're not going to read anything. Because why waste our time? You are intelligent, just like me. And then, of course, you'll start reading everything, and then you'll spend a lot of time, and you will be really mad at the exam because it took such a long time. Plus, people don't seem to give up when they're doing take home. It must be some sort of self-respect or something, but people try to figure out how to do the question. So you will wind up spending a lot more time, and clearly from my side it doesn't get graded as fast because people don't give up. So that's all I'm telling you. You know, I'm not necessarily saying what you should vote for, but, you know, by a show of hands, we're going to say how many people, I mean, majority. I cannot do two different things, okay? Whichever is the majority will get it. Okay, yes, what's the question? You don't know before voting, before voting. Right? That's an interesting question, but you don't know. I haven't set the exam, okay? So basically, by show of hands, how many people want it to be in class? Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Five people. You all looked at their faces, right? Okay. How many people want it to be take home? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. How many people would rather not have an exam? It doesn't matter. So okay, it's take home and I will give the exam out to you as soon as I can, but not before Thursday, okay? Because I want you to have the time to think about any questions you have, etc., etc. The one thing that's a reasonable stance to make, I believe, is that you cannot suddenly start realizing that you always had this real great question about value iteration after I ask you the question on value iteration in the take home. That's not allowed. Okay, you can ask me questions, but in general I decide whether or not to answer them, you know, because you are supposed to have at some point of time reached a level of nirvana, and then you should be able to answer questions yourself. Before the exam is given, you can bug me with all sorts of things. After that, you can still bug me. I might decide whether or not to answer them if it's too transparent a way of figuring out what, you know, is on the exam. That doesn't help. Okay. Any other questions on this?
When would the exam be given?
It's sometime around Thursday, Friday, it'll be given. Okay, and then I'll give you all the instructions on that, and it would basically be due definitely by about Tuesday, not beyond Tuesday. Okay, so the main thing you have is the weekend will definitely be there for you. So cancel all those general engagements. Yes. You don't have to. I mean, I think I'll basically make it, you can just bring it to the, I'll tell you the instructions, but you can just give it in the department front office or push it under my door, one of those two. Okay? So you don't need to come here necessarily. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Do you know how much of Tuesday you're going to give us?
How much of what?
How much of Tuesday we're
going to
have to work on?
I don't know. I'll just basically, probably the, I mean, I think if, the minimum is at the end of the exam time that day, but I'm not sure. Okay. And there will be. I have done this in the past, and there will be some complex rules for asking for extensions. Okay, I'm not going to allow everybody to ask for extensions, but at the same time, if you wind up having about 8 exams in the same 3 days where you are supposed to be doing this exam, you know, I'll take that into account. Okay. I'll tell you what those rules are, and then, you know, if you fall into one of those categories, you can ask me for an extension, and if I do, I'll tell you that. It'll just be, you know, one person at a time, you know, but there'll be a default deadline. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so what I am going to do today, essentially, is it's 10:45 until about 11:20, I'm going to discuss decision trees and so some of the learning stuff that we have not completely discussed. I mean, we just started discussing last time. And then about 11:20, 11:30, I'll just wrap it up with a few parting comments. Okay. So, what?
Learning. Law question
of
machine
learning. Yeah. The one on compression. Yeah.
What's the answer?
Oh, what is the answer to the compression? So, what is the answer to the compression question? Since you asked, I can answer. I mean, did people care about? So, the interesting thing is compression is about the past, about the training data. Learning is all about the test data. Okay, so in general, a lossless compression, for example, a lossless compression which is completely faithful to the training data might be a lousy learner in terms of test data, because it also fits itself to the noise in the data. So while compression and learning are closely connected, you in essence, when you start talking about lossless compression, then essentially you're saying being correct on the training examples is way more important than being correct on the test examples. Okay, so in fact, since that came up, there is a fundamental trade-off in machine learning called bias variance trade-off, and that, I don't have the picture here, so I'll just show it to you here. So if you write, for example, the error with respect to the training examples, okay? If you write the error with respect to training examples and then error with respect to the test examples as you keep increasing the training, okay? So suppose as you keep making your learning hypothesis be closer and closer and closer to the training data, okay, if you spend more and more time working on being correct with respect to the training data. In the beginning, you did not even care, your hypothesis, so you started taking something like this decision tree, which basically wasn't at all consistent with the data, but you made it more and more consistent with the training data. Okay? At the best, you would probably be able to get zero error, but if the data itself has noise, maybe you won't be able to get zero error, depending upon your hypothesis space. Okay. Now the interesting thing, of course, is as you drive down the error on the training data, how does the error on the test data work out? Okay. In the very beginning, so basic idea is, now in terms of learning, what's the difference between training and test? So in this class, right, what is the training and the test for this class? Training is all this blabbering I've been doing for this whole entire semester. What's the test? Test is exam is one narrow way of looking at it. Test is your life is actually the right way of looking at it. Okay? Any piece of knowledge you learn, you're going to use it for the rest of your life. If one day your life depended upon knowing the answer to admissibility of a heuristic, right? And if on that day, I've forgotten it by now, I'm sorry. It didn't really matter that you learned it. Many of us learn things and forget. So in reality, test phase is from here to eternity. And training phase is whatever the training is. But normally, since I don't want to kind of shadow you around and check, and when you're 65 years old or 64 years old, my God, you don't remember A-star admissibility, so I want to, ding you on the head. I don't want to do that. I don't have that time. So I'm just going to say test is just this little exam. Okay, so even in machine learning too, what they'll do is they'll take a whole bunch of data, let's say, and they say this part is the training data, this part is the test data. Okay, the real test is the life itself, of the agent. But if you want to just do some numbers, then essentially you take your entire data and then say this is training, this is test, and I'll test on the test data. Okay, so now if I'm essentially checking the error on the test data while I become closer and closer to the training data, right? How is it going to look like? In the beginning, it's clear that the error on the training data is going to be, test data is going to be high too, right? And you would think that it should come down, but it could also start going up. Because at some point of time, you reduced your error. So the point is, think about again me teaching you in this class. If you completely slept through the class, don't expect to do well in the exams. Right? I mean, unless you don't need me as a learner. Okay. Now, if on the other hand, if you did not sleep through and you did homework, etc., based on the training, you'll start doing well in the exam. But you have gone beyond the bend and you are actually taking every little sentence I'm saying and internalizing it. Okay? Then once in a while I'll make mistakes in this class and you'll internalize those mistakes too. Okay? And then in the exam, you know, of course, especially if I set the exam, you can come and whine to me saying, you said so in the class. But if somebody else just sets the exam, which is the way life works, you know, the fact that some bozo taught you the wrong definition of admissibility doesn't help you. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay? So you should be careful. Don't listen to anybody. I mean, that's why there's this thing called take everything with a pinch of salt. That's essentially what is that telling you? Taking things with a pinch of salt is saying don't overfit to the training data. If you overfit to the training data, unless your teacher is omniscient and never makes any mistakes, you tend to lose out on the test. Okay? So that's exactly what happens in real life, and this is called the bias variance trade-off. And what this is telling you with respect to your question is, if you are doing compression, right, you should be driving down, the lossless compression drives down the error on the training data. And I'm also telling you, those could be the lousy learners, if there is noise. Okay? That's the answer to that thing. No, it's on the training data, it's correct, but the training data may be incorrect to begin with. See, remember, in the class, I might have told you some things wrong in some classes. So I'm a noisy teacher. And similarly, your examples also could be noisy. If the examples are not noisy, then there is nothing wrong in completely fitting to the data. But real life, you expect examples to be noisy. Real life, you expect teachers to be bozos. And you should be careful as to, I mean, generally, over and above, if the teacher hasn't been fired yet, probably they don't tell everything that's wrong. But at the same time, there is no guarantee that they're telling you everything that's right. Okay? Okay, so what we're going to do is learn a little algorithm, which is learning how to do decision trees. Okay, so I told you last time that if you have some data, this is like a classification scenario, for the Russell restaurant scenario, and if you just want to classify this, you could learn it based on which hypothesis space. So you want to learn the pattern in it, and you need to express the pattern in some representation. Okay, so the representation that you're using is essentially the hypothesis space. So if you think this can be represented in terms of decision trees, then your hypothesis space is the set of all decision trees. And when I left last class, I pointed out that if you have n Boolean variables, forget about multi-value, just Boolean variables, n Boolean features here, then the number of Boolean functions would be 2^2n. And it turns out any Boolean function can be represented by a decision tree. Any Boolean function at all can be represented by a decision tree, which essentially means there will be at least 2^2n different decision trees. And all you need to do really is to be able to just go through each of these 2^2n decision trees and see which of them fits the data best and pick that one. So in fact, what I just said, is there a search in learning? There is no in this type of learning. All learning has search. Okay, if you think there is no search, you have to ask, what are you trying to, cut short? Whenever you see a learning algorithm that doesn't have a search, you have to ask yourself, how come it's getting away without search? It must be making some major assumptions. Okay, so learning has search. More than that, what kind of a search is it? Is it just finding a hypothesis? I sort of said find the hypothesis that fits the data the best. That fits the data the best. Okay? So the interesting point about that is that you can actually define what it means to fit the data. So the simplest idea is the number of training examples that your hypothesis classifies correctly is the fit. But when it misclassifies something, so it should not misclassify. So misclassification error rate should be zero. But you could go beyond that and say certain errors are much bigger than certain other errors. So when you misclassify, you have two types of errors. One is false positive and one is false negative. False positive and false negative. So the actual example is a negative, but your hypothesis falsely says it's a positive example. And false negative means the hypothesis is actually positive, the example is positive, but the hypothesis says negative. Now if you go to a doctor and they do a test and they try to tell you you have a disease when you don't have it, then what is it? So you basically don't have the disease, so you don't, negative is the actual answer, but this guy said positive. Okay, and false positive and then false negative on the other hand means that you actually have the disease, but this guy is saying you don't have it. Now which is better? It depends. It really depends. Okay? So the important thing is that I don't necessarily have to say false positives and false negatives cost the same. I can give different numbers to them. I can say each false positive is 3 points worth and each false negative is 10 points worth. And then now when I'm comparing different decision trees in terms of how best they fit the data, then I will get, you know, something which makes more false positive errors is better than something which makes more false negative errors. Do you understand what I'm saying? And we live like that. So for example, if you are a credit card company, so for example, if you are a junk mailing company, okay, you're just junk sending mails to people, you know, by email, and you're hoping that some sucker will click on that for that Nigerian millions. Right, that apparently every time they want to give it to me. Okay, so the question is, what are they trying to minimize there? False positives or false negatives? Think about it. If you are an advertiser sending email spam, and they are trying to obviously, you know, assume that even they cannot send it to the entire world, so they have to pick people. You know, these kinds of people are likely to be suckers. They want to send them mails. Okay, the question is, in doing this, what are they more interested in minimizing, false positives or false negatives? What? Whoever wants to say it, and then justify. One of these days, this is what you'll be doing, right? Because most of us are sending spam mails to each other. So the question is, what do you think you should be minimizing?
They want to minimize false positives because they don't want to take the time and the money to send the email when they may not get a response.
You are so old time. Right? In the sense, do you really think spam guys actually are spending any money? These were the old days when essentially you had real junk mail where the postman or the postwoman would come all the way and give it to you. Right? Right now, sending another million mails is a couple of pennies. What they're really worried about is false negatives. So there is this sucker in Tempe, and who would actually buy all of this stuff. And by for some reason, we thought Tempe is a university town, nobody would be a sucker there, and we didn't send any mails to Tempe, and so we missed this one person. That's what they're interested in. You see what I'm saying, right? And so if you're a doctor, it may be a different idea. So the point I'm trying to make is, in deciding which is the hypothesis that fits the data best, you need a cost model. You need a model about which kind of errors are important. If they're all equally important, that's one thing. If not, you need to take into account the cost. And then having done this, you want to find the hypothesis that best fits the data according to your cost model. So it's a search, but it's also something else. It's optimization. What? No, assume that I am given that information to you. That means I tell you that every false positive is 3 points costly and every false negative is 10 points costly. Now if I give you a specific decision tree, you can apply it to the training data, see what it says, and see if it says it's positive when it is positive, if it says negative and it's negative, those things are good. If it says positive when it is actually negative, then it's a false positive. If it says negative when it's actually positive, then it's a false negative. And for each of those errors, you add out those numbers. There is no such, listen, all I'm saying is, again, remove the magic. Okay, there is a big bag of hypotheses. This happens to be a 2^2 n sized bag of decision trees. You pick one up and check whether it fits the data, you know, and it gets a score. So you keep it. This is your score. Now I'm trying to find the decision tree that has the best score. That's what machine learning is. There is no magic. You can't, I can't teach you magic, and you can't learn magic. Okay? And starting from there, you want to do it fast. Okay? So there are 2^2 n hypotheses, and then you're trying to figure out which of them has the best score. And so learning is a search, and learning is an optimization search. It's an optimization search. Having said this, the very first learning algorithm I'll give you, you would see that there is no search at all, and that you won't even do optimization. And you should be worried. And then remember that the difference between a computer scientist and a programmer is one knows what optimality is and gives it up, and one doesn't know and doesn't care. Okay? So you have to realize that in the ideal case, what you're trying to do in machine learning is search through the space of hypotheses and find the best fitting hypothesis according to a score function. But if you want to do this for this data, then essentially what you would do is you would be spending time that is essentially, I mean, if you do it in the dumbest way possible, then you would do 2^2 n decision trees have to be evaluated to find which is the best one. And even if you are not dumb, you know, it turns out, as I said at the end of the last class, that there are certain, you know, minimum bounds. If in fact your hypothesis space size is H, then you need essentially to train your hypothesis space on a data of at least size log of H, okay, to get anywhere near close to being correct. Okay, and so this essentially, this is the sample complexity, which, by the way, is the way you decide whether somebody is a good learner or a bad learner. You know, if you think about students, right, there are some students who essentially will do extremely well in all these A-star questions by about September. And I have a lot of respect for them. Their brains work. They're just somewhat slower. Okay, today is the exam. Tomorrow is the exam. They will figure out everything by September. So in life, they're doing, going to do well with probably a bad GPA card, but they'll do quite well. Okay, there are some people who knew everything on the test like before the course started. And there are some people who might take forever, and even before they die, they still have no clue whether it's A-star is admissible or not admissible for a particular heuristic. Ultimately, you differentiate learners, and you are one of them, based on the number of samples you need to reach a level of accuracy. Okay? This is why when you're talking about learners, you talk about sample complexity. And when you evaluate learners, you draw pictures like this. When you evaluate learners, you draw a picture like this. Number of training examples. So remember, I had some bunch of data that's labeled. I split it into training set. Let's say I have 100 examples or something. So I split it into training set, and a small part of it is a test set. I keep the test set separately, and I train myself on the training data. What is training supposed to mean? There's no magic. Training means take all the, you know, decision trees and see which of them fit those 90 examples the best, and pick that one. Okay? And then test it on the test data. Except when you have 90 examples, you might start by just training on first 3 examples, 10 examples, 20 examples, 50 examples, etc. More and more examples. Okay? And then you are asking, how is your accuracy? This is 100% accuracy, this is zero accuracy. So here are a couple of learners. This is what you want to be, right? That's unfortunately what, for example, medical research tells us autistic kids tend to be. You know, the difference between autistic kids and normal kids is negligible when they are in the earlier grades. But then at some point of time, they plateau out. Okay? So they learn just as fast, but they never really reach. Whatever they reach and then they stick there. And you can have a learner like this. That's a slow learner, but it reaches 100% accuracy if you give it time. Okay? When you have an artificial learner like this, that means your hypothesis space is so restrictive that there is no way within those hypothesis space you can ever learn the concept. That's the basic idea. Okay? And when you are like this, the hypothesis space is so large that before you can figure out which of the hypotheses fit, you need lots and lots of data to separate them out. So in general, in trying to figure out what is a good learning algorithm, in this case, what's a good learning algorithm? Clearly, if you could draw one, this, if you can get this, that's what you want. Next best is this. But on the other hand, if you are interested in just getting up to 60% accuracy fast, then you know this guy is probably fine enough. Okay? So that's how you're going to decide. Once you learn a decision tree, that's what you're going to do. Okay, so coming back, we're going to look for the best decision tree that fits this data. Since there are 2^2 n of them and it's going to take too long, I would be greedy. I would say, even though I know I'm supposed to be searching through all the space, let me try to construct one decision tree that's likely to be pretty darn good with respect to its fit in the data. There is no guarantee that it will be the optimal such decision tree, but it will be fast to construct it. So I want now a greedy method. So a greedy method for any optimization problem is one which tries to construct a solution that may not be optimal, but it's fast to construct, and it's not really bad either. Okay? So let's do that. So I want to construct something like this for the Russell example. Okay, and this is actually a decision tree is nothing but a 20 questions AI style. Okay, so you're asking, starting from top, you're asking, are there any patterns? And if the example says none, you know that the answer is no, because in all these examples, when the patterns are none, I can't see it properly, when the patterns are none, he winds up not staying in the restaurant. Okay? So you want to say that whenever the patterns are none, the answer is no. When the patterns are some, the answer is yes. When the patterns is full, that means none, some, and full. So that means the restaurant is full, then you decide whether or not to stay based on other questions. And that's what this picture is saying. Now what's the whole point of 20 questions, the problem? I mean, if you're asking 20 questions, you should ask questions that will give you the information the fastest way. So if you ever have to ask 20 questions game with your friend, don't ask them, how has your day been? You know, have you had good breakfast today? Unless you think the question is something about breakfast. Okay, every useless question is wasted. You know, no dilly-dallying, just get to the best question you can so that you can basically tell with the fewest questions whether something is, the answer is yes or no. Okay? So I would say a method for greedily constructing the decision tree is very simple, actually. Okay? All I do is, these are all called attributes. Alternative, Friday, patterns, all these column names, they are the attributes, are a feature. Okay? Pick an attribute, split the data on that attribute, split the training data on that attribute. If an attribute, let's say, is patterns can have value none, some, or full. Split all the training examples into one bag where the answer for the value of patterns is none, another bag where it is some, another bag where it is full. And then, if the entire bag happens to be all negative, that means the answer for all those training examples is don't stay, then you're done. If all of them are positive also, you're done. If it's mixed, you have to do this recursively. That's it. Okay, so that's the decision tree learning algorithm, to construct a greedy decision tree. This is not going to be the best such decision tree because I'm not doing optimization. I'm not actually looking at the entire space of decision trees. This is a reasonably fast way of constructing the decision tree. Now, the $1 million question here is pick an attribute. which is like saying pick a question to ask. The one thing that's different between normal 20 questions and decision trees is the space of questions is completely specified, because the only questions you're going to ask are the questions on each of these attributes. What's the value of this attribute? Right? In 20 questions, I don't know what questions to ask. Okay? So, fine. Now, basically, I have to pick an attribute. That's all I need to do. If I know how to do that, then I have a decision tree learning algorithm. I'm done. The question is, how do I pick the attribute? Okay? Now, so to figure out which is the right way to do, take a couple of examples and see which of them is good, which of them is bad, and then try to find some way of giving them numbers. Right? That's the idea. So here is one decision tree. Here is another decision tree. It turns out that both of them essentially fit the data about the same. In fact, in terms of false positives and false negatives, I mean, none of them have any false positives or false negatives. They both fit the data completely. Which would you rather pick?
Right.
Ask your question. Because if you ask more questions, in some sense, you tend to fit yourself to all possible noise in the data. Whereas if you can get the same accuracy with fewer questions, that's much better. You're likely to do better on the training cases and on the test cases. Okay? So you agree, I think, that this is a better thing than this. This is the bad scenario. Okay? So when I'm picking an attribute, suppose I pick patterns as one choice and type as the other choice. Remember, there are only like 10 attributes. You consider all of them, picking all of them and see which one is the best. Okay? So instead of picking one of 2^2 n decision trees, now I'm only picking which of the 10 attributes to ask question on. That's a much smaller thing to do. Okay? So I could split it on patterns and I'll get like this. I can split it on type, I'll get like this. So you know that from the full tree point of view, this is a better full tree than this. Now, you are going to construct these trees starting from here. You're trying to figure out which local decision is likely to get you to the globally best decision tree. This is a greedy approach because you're trying to make local decisions and hoping for the globally optimal thing, which won't happen, but you're trying. Okay? So, which one of these is better? Clearly this, because at least in this case, you're done here, you just have to do this. Whereas here, you just basically split it into 4 more problems and they just know better off than anything else. It's like saying, basically you're asking irrelevant questions. So it's not able to differentiate the data much. So what I need is a magic function which will give this a bigger number and this a smaller number. Because, imagine writing a computer program which, after every iteration will show you the decision trees, and you have to say this one, right? And if as much as you hated doing programming, you'd hate doing programming even more if you're part of it even during the runtime, right? So you want it to be able to tell between these two, that's better, right? So I need a numerical measure which says that one is better. How do I do that? It turns out that an idea called entropy of a system is a very useful thing in this place. Okay? And let me just tell you what entropy of a system is. If I have, let's say, if I have one of n events is going to happen right now, one of n events is going to happen. And they will happen, so event 1, etc., up to event n, and they will happen with the following probabilities. Then I would say that the entropy of the system is minus pi log pi. Okay, it looks like I threw something out of my hat and put a number there, right? But this is a beautiful idea, because let's think of what happens if you just have 2 events, P1 and P2, E1 and E2, one of them is going to happen, okay? Now the question is, what is the entropy of the system? When do you know the least amount about this system? Okay, if P1 equal to 1.0, think of entropy as the disorder. That's what you remember from, how many of you have done thermodynamics? Yeah, so engineering college is falling apart. We are supposed to be in engineering and we don't know thermodynamics. But, you know, thermodynamics tells you that entropy is the measure of disorder. Okay, so disorder in this case is, based on this probability, how little do you know about the system? If I say this is 1.0, this is 0.0, I know everything about this system. If I say this is 0.0 and this is 1.0, I again know everything about this system. So the entropy of the system is going to be 0 here and 0 here. And the probability, I'll just write P1 from 0 to 1.0. And when P1 becomes 1.0, P2 becomes 0. This formula basically will be P1 log P1 plus 1 minus P1 log 1 minus P1. The whole thing minus actually. Right, that's what this formula is saying. Now if you draw that, essentially, it would look like that. And becomes highest at P equal to half. Now, if you don't have a good feel for it, think about the following thing. You want to start a weather bureau. This is my favorite example for making this point. You want to start a weather bureau, okay? Basically, in the middle of the summer, you want to start your weather bureau, and it's going to pay, you know, it's going to basically take money from people and tell them whether or not sun will come up. I mean, it will be a sunny day tomorrow or not. Okay, let's say, right? So you have two places where you can start your weather bureau. Imagine that the suckers that you're dealing with don't know that internet exists or TV exists, okay? There are two places that you are trying to start your weather bureau, Tempe and London. Where would you start it? Where would you start it? Tempe? Tempe is because you don't want to take a bus to London. But nobody is going to pay any money to you if in summer you're trying to tell them whether the sun is going to come tomorrow or not. Because they say, why should we pay? We have been here forever and ever and the sun shows up every damn day.
My
and we're getting sick.
Will always be right.
What?
My prediction.
I know, but is anybody going to pay you any money?
Maybe
capitalist. It's a good point. Basically, you want to sell information that people are going to pay money for. Why would anybody in Tempe pay you money for finding out whether there will be sun tomorrow or not in a summer day? On the other hand, it's been said about London that if you don't like the weather, wait for an hour, it will change. Do you understand what I'm saying? So in London, weather is notoriously unpredictable. Even in the middle of summer, you can get sunny days, rainy days, you know, rain, this, that, everything. So if you have any hope of making any money, it's in London, not in Tempe. And that's because sunny, not sunny, so Tempe is 1.0, maybe actually 1.7, and 0, the other side. Whereas London is much more like maybe 0.5-ish and 0.5-ish. It's anybody's guess. That's why you want to start this in London. Okay? And so the entropy, the amount of entropy is also the amount of business opportunity you have to, if you are trying to sell the information. Okay? So now if I have that idea in my mind, right? So of course, now if I did pick the patterns, then I will split it into these three parts, and this would be yes, this would be no, and now I'm going to recursively do the same thing starting from here. Okay? So the question is, how did I get a number for this and a number for this, and decide one is better? And the idea is, this is the slide that you have to very carefully look at, not that carefully, so basically, when you are here, there are n plus positive examples. Imagine it's a two-class classification problem still, and n minus negative examples. So the probability that a random example is positive is n plus by n plus plus n minus. And that the probability that a random example is negative is n minus by n plus plus n minus. So the entropy of this system is minus of p plus log p plus minus of p minus log p minus. By the time you came here, you already thought about this. So you know that this is a reasonable thing to do. So this is the amount of disorder here. When you are asking questions, are you trying to increase or reduce the disorder? What?
Reduce.
Okay. So what you want to do is pick the feature where you will come here and the amount of entropy here is the much lower than here, or the difference is the highest. Or alternately, after this, there is very little disorder left in the system. So you should be able to guess what the label is. Right? Okay. So if I split on feature Fk, let's say there were n1 plus positive examples. Okay, so the feature Fk, let's say, has k possible values. You know, Fk can be value 1, value 2, etc., all the way up to value k. So that's why there are, you know, k possible branches. And in each branch, you are talking only about the set of these examples which have that value for that feature. Okay, so for example, this was patterns and this is none. These are all examples where pattern equal to none. And of those, there may be some are positive, some are negative. And so you can again talk about probability of the entropy of this system is I of P1 plus and P1 minus and P2 plus, P2 minus, PK plus, PK minus. Now the question, of course, is what is the total entropy of this system? That depends on whether you fell into this branch or this branch or this branch. If you assume that all values of a feature are equally likely, all values of feature are equally likely, then in essence all you can say is the probability that you would come here is the, it's not that way. If you assume that the number of examples here tells you how likely that particular value of the feature is, okay, then the probability you will come this side is n1 plus n1 minus, which is the total number of examples here, divided by total number of examples to begin with. Right? So what I would do is I am doing this. I'm taking ni plus ni minus divided by the total number of examples. That's the probability times the entropy. This is the expected entropy of the system. Expected entropy of the system. You can actually do now, for each feature, you will be able to compute the expected entropy. And all you need to do is pick the feature whose expected entropy reduces the most from the original entropy. So either you can pick the feature that gives the biggest difference between these two, or you can pick the feature that has the lowest value here, which is the same, because the difference is always with respect to the same constant. Right? That will give you which feature to pick. That's all I want to do. And I'm done. So here is a little example. I'll quickly go over it and you can look at it more carefully. So this is, you know, very apropos example about students with their attributes and whether or not they hate exams. Okay? And so masochistic, anxious, nerdy are the three Boolean attributes I'm looking at, and the final label is yes, they hate exams, no, they don't hate exams. Okay? And the question, of course, is I'm trying to learn a Bayesian tree for this. So in the beginning, Bayesian tree is empty. That means no questions are asked. So you're trying to figure out the first question. So it turns out that you need to decide whether to split on masochistic or anxious or nerdy. And if you do the calculations the way I asked you to do, okay, which is basically worked out there, you would see that masochistic, after you do the masochistic, the amount of entropy left is 1. And disorder left is 1. After anxious, the disorder left is 0. After nerdy, the disorder left is 1. So which would you rather ask as the first question? Anxious. So you just learned that people, you know, who are anxious tend to hate exams. That's the only question you need to ask according to this data. Okay? So this is decision tree learning. And if you use this decision tree learning on the Russell data, then you'll get a decision tree like that. So you'll start with patterns, then you ask hungry, then you ask type, then you ask is it Friday or Thursday. You're done. And the maximum questions you will ever ask is this. Minimum questions you ask is just one. Okay? Now, this way of constructing the decision tree, did I go through all 2 power n decision trees? No. Have I just proved to myself that I can do optimization on a large space in linear time? No. There must be something I gave up. Okay? And in fact, it turns out that the questions that you are asking here are always on a single attribute. And in the homework, I gave you the Seinfeld example, which I wish you had the time to do. If I did do this last week, you would have done it. And it turns out that a bad party, if you know Seinfeld, is one where both Seinfeld and Newman are present. If any one of them is present, it's a good party. Okay, they can get along with other people. But those two are the sworn enemies. And so if they both of them are present, the party goes down the drain. So in that case, really, if you ask questions on is Seinfeld there, is Newman there, you would not get the optimal decision tree. If on the other hand, you ask, is Seinfeld Newman? Yes, yes, or yes, no, or no, yes, or no, no. You'll get a smaller decision tree. So all you need to do, it turns out, to get the optimal decision trees using this idea, this greedy idea, is to not only split on single attributes, but split also on subsets of attributes. Just subsets of attributes. Right? And then you will get a smaller tree. But how many subsets of attributes are there? The same old devil. It's 2 power n subsets of attributes. Okay? So rather than ask, you know, 10 questions as to which of the attributes should I split it on, now we'll be asking 2 power 10 questions as to which of the subsets of the attributes should I be splitting on. And if I do ask that, I will get optimal decision tree. Okay? Otherwise, it's a greedy decision tree. It works fine, but it's not guaranteed to be the optimal or the smallest decision tree. Okay? Now, this is a picture that basically shows you that in the decision trees, in the Russell domain, this is basically the curve that I used to have earlier for the learning curve. These are called learning curves. So if I increase the number of examples on which the decision tree learner is training, and then I test it on the same test set, then you'll notice that very quickly it reaches about 90% accuracy and then hangs around there. Looks like even though it's a greedy approach, it's a pretty fast learner. So I'll try to push my luck and I want to learn majority function. Majority function is also a Boolean function. Okay? If you have 10,000 Boolean attributes, majority function says yes if a majority of them are yes, and no if it says a majority of them are no. Do you understand that? It's a very simple concept to learn. You can learn it. Can your decision tree learn it? And you'll notice that for the majority function, you know, the training, the decision tree crawls. Literally crawls. As the number of examples are increased, it's just slowly improving its accuracy. It doesn't look all that hot anymore. Why is that? Why is it? Because every bias winds up making certain concepts easier to learn, certain harder to learn. Okay? And what are the concepts that decision trees can learn well? If the Boolean function you are about to learn can be represented essentially in terms of a very small subset of the attributes, then you can learn a pretty good decision tree for that concept. If on the other hand, the worst case would be the function depends on every attribute, every little attribute. Okay, in the majority, this is the reason. I mean, you know, Minnesota, they're still not sure who won. Why? Because every vote has to be counted. And then you have to figure out what the majority is. In the worst case, majority requires every vote to be counted, and then you go to, you know, local court, Supreme Court, High Court, everything, right? And the basic problem is, in this case, you need a function that asks questions ultimately, in the worst case, on every possible attribute. And those are the worst kind of functions for decision tree. because there the decision tree would be almost as big. I mean, its depth essentially has to be the number of attributes. Right? Okay? That's why in the case of majority function, decision trees don't do as well. Okay? Now, very quickly, so this I already told you approximately the problems with decision tree. I'll skip over that. And I just want to tell you something mostly in the following sense, that for the same exact data, you could have learned, and this is not required for, so you know, you can hear it with much less anxiety as far as the exam is concerned. So you could learn a Bayes network that best suits the data. Now, when you're trying to learn the Bayes network that best suits the data, you have to make two questions. First is, what's the topology of the Bayes network? And the second question is, what are the CPTs? I'll make one simple for you. I'll say the topology of the Bayes network is always this way. This is the class label, and these are all the attributes. So suppose I go ahead and make a very strong bias, and I say my examples, essentially the label of the examples is the disease, and all the attributes are the symptoms. And all attributes are independent given the disease. That's what that network is telling you. There are many, many networks I could have drawn on this set of nodes, but if I assume that the only network I'm going to look at is this, then the topology is decided. The only thing I need is these numbers. These numbers can be got by just counting examples which have certain property divided by the total number of examples. So the huge step you made here is you said this is basically a naive Bayes classifier, where you are saying all attributes are independent given the class label. This is a Bayes network, by the way. And you know, in the Bayes network, if your immediate parent is given, then you are independent of your siblings. Right? If I'm only picking the best such naive Bayes network, it turns out that it's extremely simple. I would not go into details, but you know, you can easily look it up in the slides after we leave. All you wind up doing is you will need probabilities of the following type: the prior probability that Russell would wait at all. Okay, and that would be the total number of examples is 12, and the number of examples where he waits is 6. So 6 over 12 is that example, that number. And then you also would need numbers of the type, what is the probability that patrons would be equal to full if you know that Russell is waiting at that restaurant. Right? And that would be, look only at the places where Russell is waiting, and then see the probability among those rows, see how many of them have patrons equal to full. And it turns out there are 6 rows in which he's waiting, and only 2 of them have patrons equal to full. So this probability is 2/6. These are the only numbers you would need. And then you can then compute, essentially using Bayes rule, you can compute, given a bunch of attributes and their values, you know, in the test example, what is the probability that Russell would wait? An extremely easy thing to do. You know, this is looks even simpler compared to that greedy decision tree learning. Now, what is interesting, the reason I wanted to tell you this is this. If you do the naive Bayes classifier on the same data, okay, decision tree is here, naive Bayes classifier is here. It turns out it's not particularly as good as the decision tree. Okay, in this case. However, one of the interesting things about naive Bayes classifiers is, in every example, it's able to take every attribute's value and see how much it contributes to the class label. Okay? And so, for example, if you are trying to decide based on certain words appearing in a mail, whether the mail is a spam mail or not, oftentimes spam mails depend, the classification that a mail is a spam mail depends pretty much on all the words present in it, not just a couple of magic bullets. For spam mail classification, decision tree would be this lower one, and naive Bayes classifier would be the higher one. And in fact, some years back, I was at a Google faculty summit, and somebody asked Peter Narvig, who is the second author of your textbook. He said, we have this machine learning research department in Google. They asked him, so what do you do? And he said, we mostly do naive Bayes classifiers. And that's what this is. Okay. Now, it turns out that naive Bayes classifier should not work at all, because it's making these huge assumptions about independence between attributes given the disease. But it winds up working fine most of the time. And especially it works very well if the class label really depends on all the attributes rather than just a few of them, which actually happens to be the exact case that's bad for decision trees. Majority function, naive Bayes classifier would do better. And decision trees will do worse. Spam mail classification, naive Bayes will do better, decision trees will do worse. Whereas Russell's example, decision trees will do better, naive Bayes will do worse. Okay? So I told you about 1.5 ideas about how to learn, and in both cases I started by saying you need to do search, but then I avoided doing search in this class. Okay? Just to look forward, it turns out that there are machine learning algorithms now that actually do actual optimization. So, for example, one particular class of learners essentially thinks of all the examples as points in a high-dimensional space. Okay? And then all it's then trying to do is get an equation of a line or a curve such that above it is all positive, below it is all negative. Now it turns out there are many, many such lines. This is a line, that's a line, that's a line, that's a line, that's a line. Which of them is the best? You would say the ones that are better are sort of here, because they are farthest from the closest positive and the closest negative example. So you are not dependent too much on any example, any single example being wrongly classified. Okay? So you give yourself maximum margin from the closest positives and negatives. And these are called max margin classifiers, and you will hear about them later as support vector machines. A great name, support vector machines. And the support vectors here are the closest positive example and the closest negative example for that line. And finding that equation of that line can be written as essentially an optimization problem, a convex optimization problem. So you do optimization sometimes, but sometimes you decide to go as far as you can with just greedy approaches. So the decision trees and naive Bayes classifiers just go with greedy approaches. And in fact, in the naive Bayes classifier, you made a huge assumption up front, saying the hypothesis will have a certain shape. In decision tree, you didn't make such an assumption, because all Boolean functions are available. It's just that you wound up picking one very fast in a greedy way. These are two different ways you made the assumptions there. Okay, so I'm going to stop there as far as the technical part of the class is concerned. I think I have about 5 minutes, and I'm going to say, we'll do a review, okay, about what we did, the class. So this is what we did. These are all the topics we did. This is before the midterm, this is after the midterm, okay? And another way of looking at it is, we started with a goal-based agent architecture, and we said it has an architecture like this, and we said to represent state and how the world evolves and goals, I need representation mechanisms. We looked at propositional, first order, and probabilistic logic representations. And to decide how the world evolves and what the world would do if I do something, I need to do search or planning. And we did variety of search and planning techniques here. Okay, there's the normal atomic search, there is the planning based on progression and regression, and there is the Markov decision processes. Okay? And then, where does this knowledge come from? If somebody doesn't write this knowledge, you have to learn. And that's the part that I just started touching towards the end of the course. So that's where it all fits in this picture. Okay. If you look at the textbook, this is the chapters in the textbook, and the ones in green are what we have done, I think, pretty much. Ones in red we did not do at all, pretty much. Okay. And then ones in brown, I must have mentioned them at some level or other. So if you're trying to decide, given that that textbook is a reasonable survey of the overall field, you know which parts we definitely did not do. Okay. Now, of course, I've been told many, many times that it doesn't matter what you cover, it matters what you uncover. And the problem is, I will never know what I uncover, right? This is some of my favorite cartoons about, you know, in this particular case, we are talking in big, big sentences to the dog, and the dog hears that, okay? And so I can say whatever I want, I don't quite know what you got, right? And the question really is, as far as this course is concerned, it matters what you got, not what I said. And that's why I forced you to do the interactive semester review, okay? I think about 28 of you wrote what still sticks in your mind, and I think you should look it up. And I will definitely look it up and make sure that anything that's already sticking in your mind, I won't ask you questions on it on the exam. Anything that's not sticking in your mind, I'll write more questions on it. But I think it's a very useful summary of what you actually got collectively from the course. You know, it doesn't matter what I said you got. You know, I realize that everybody says A star search, maybe because that's the first thing and that's the only thing they heard before they fell asleep for the rest of the semester. That's fine. That's one thing you learned. Okay? So you might want to look at not only what you learned, but what the other people learned to see if in fact there is something that, you know, these other guys got that you didn't get. Because, you know, maybe next day there would be a Google job interview and they'll get it and you won't get it and you would feel bad. Okay? So make sure that you figure out what the other people got. Okay, and this is my usual slide I end a semester with. It's, you know, despite what you might think, I always think the semesters are too short and I feel we haven't done enough things that I should be doing. And so this, how many of you have seen Schindler's List? So this is the last part of Schindler's List, of the movie, and of course there's this whole dialogue, right, about what he could have done. And if I had more time, these are some of the things, these are some of the things that I would have done extra. I think we would have spent more time on statistical learning. I would have spent more time on reinforcement learning, bagging and boosting. I would have spent more time on planning under uncertainty and incompleteness. I would have spent more time on some ideas like induced tree width, which is graph theoretic properties, either of constraint graphs or Bayes networks, which are connected to the complexity of reasoning with them, okay? And I would have spent more time on multi-agent X, where X can be anything, search, you know, learning and so on. And I would have probably spent at least some time on perception, which is very important because we are not touching the perception at this point. And, you know, that's sort of the thing that I would have looked at if I had more time. Thankfully, I do have a separate course on Intro to AI, you know, at the graduate level that I'll be teaching next semester. Those of you who are truly masochistic can still sign up for it, and it would just start off where we left off in this course. Okay. And then the last thing is Marvin Minsky, who's one of the pioneers who sort of considered one of the three people who started the field of AI, has once said that with understanding comes a sense of loss. You know, once you understand how things are working, then it's no longer AI. Okay, and so then software engineers will start dealing with it, and then AI people think we should do something else. And of course, AI people are not getting any jobs because everybody else is taking credit for this, all this other stuff. But that's a different story. My fond hope is that if you came to this course thinking, you know, intelligence is a magical thing, I hope you lost some of that wonder. Okay, and I hope you also experience some sense of loss, not just of the whole semester spent unwisely, but maybe of something that you learn. Thank you. That's it. Yes, make sure that you give the evaluation things here. I'm sorry, the semester participation thing. What? Yeah, there you go.
If we have a question on a grade on a project, do we need to review or is it?
If it's a project, first talk to Yun Sang.
You said I can drop a project in, I forgot it at home. If I forgot it at home, I can drop a project in at Yun Sang.
Okay.
I wanted to ask a few questions.
Let me get it out of you. Just one second.